I'm feeling it.
That's it.
Awesome. Boom. Button is hit. Testing uno, testing dos, testando. That's not how you say it, but I said it anyway.
Yeah.
Alan, you sound good already.
God, Splinter's getting busted up by missiles right now.
Are you playing Shredder's Revenge?
I am.
Oh, dude, I've been on such a Turtles kick lately. Welcome to SmaffCast, episode 30. This is the big 3-0, Alan.
Oh, wow.
We've officially entered middle age, I think. I don't know. Middle age might be more 40 these days.
Middle age shouldn't be 40, but it seems to be nowadays.
Shredder's Revenge is a dope video game. We talked about video games a few episodes ago. Maybe Shredder's Revenge should be a game that we get into on one of our first gaming episodes that we've been planning to do.
Definitely.
Shredder's my daughter will play with us too. It's so much fun. So yeah, I've been on a big Ninja Turtles kick lately. I just finished the first series of The Last Ronin. And then they did The Last Ronin Lost Years, which I'm in the middle of right now. Talk about masterful comic writing.
Oh yeah.
And
they did a good job with that.
And the martial arts. I mean, that's the reason I bring it up, not just because Ninja Turtles, but particularly in The Lost Years, I'm discovering not to give any spoilers, but Michelangelo goes through his wanderer training, as it were. Mm-hmm. And he learns Wing Chun and he learns Mongolian martial arts. And there's just very interesting. They use technical terms. And I just thought it was very cool because for anybody who's read the original Ninja Turtles comics by Eastman and Laird from the 80s onward, and even the IDW comics that they did starting maybe a decade ago, for Eastman and Laird, they never did martial arts. So the fact that they kind of had an understanding of how the martial arts worked just based on watching kung fu movies and stuff, first of all, that's just a testament to how we do saber martial arts now in a big way, right? But also, the fact that they could be even moderately accurate with drawings on these things.
Well, remember that they were being fed by, the era as well.
Oh, for sure. Yes.
Still.
Oh yeah, martial arts cinema was hot. All the comic books of the time were heavy on the martial arts lore. Yeah, for sure. But in this fast forward to now, in this Lost Years of The Last Ronin, you can see the evolution of Kevin Eastman as a martial arts writer. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure.
Because it actually is studied and accurate to a large degree versus kind of
I'm pretty sure over the past 30 years, people are like, hey man, I know you did great things for my childhood. Let's give you a little
bit. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's great though.
Some authenticity to this.
It's really good. And, if anybody likes comics, I highly recommend you check out the Last Ronin and The Last Ronin Lost Years. Plus, if you're a Turtles fan, you're going to cry your little eyes out and, make sure you don't cry over the nice glossy pages. So Shredder's Revenge, great game. If you hear a clicking, that's Alan's thumb on the square button, most likely. And we're going to keep it in because we like it here. So... Alan, what's going on? Anything interesting? Any updates to your martial arts? Any updates to life?
Well, a couple of fun things that I'm into right now is I'm doing a lot of Bagua right now. Those of you that follow The Last Airbender, that is the airbending, the style that airbending is based upon. So... it's one of those games that you try to figure out, right? And it's kind of interesting to look at and kind of see, okay, well, what are we doing? What's the intention of each thing? Because it's really hard to teach unless you're teaching one-on-one, because you literally have to walk in circles.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you're a student, that's really tough to follow, right? Because your teacher ends up behind you, and then he ends up on the side of you, and et cetera, et cetera. So when you're actually doing certain martial arts, there is a different way of teaching. And one of the things that is different in Bagua is every single martial art has their version of a wooden man, right?
You're right. Yep.
So there's always some sort of thing that you can do to strike and or hit, and it's usually something made out of wood. In Wing Chun, it is literally the wooden man, you know, that everybody has probably seen in
like 90% of the movies. Jackie Chan movies ever released.
Yeah, Jackie Chan movies, the Ip Man movies.
The Ip Man movies, you know? Yep.
And like, there's a lot of stuff that is actually, you know, the wooden man is not a new idea. It's been around for a very long time.
It's the original, yeah, the original punching bag, the original heavy bag.
Right. So it's kind of interesting because Bagua has eight. And what you do, or nine, depending on how you arrange them. But basically you have different posts that you would use. So you like a fence post, like that holds up a fence. they're arranged in specific orders, and a lot of the different styles of Bagua, because there are different styles of this martial art, just like there are different styles of every martial art, uses them in different ways. Sometimes you're standing on top of them, on top of the posts. Sometimes you're standing in between them or on the outside of them, striking the posts as you do your form. Some of the best ones.
What you might call a pel in a European style of martial arts training.
Yeah, exactly. Last I checked, there was not a lot of European styles that stood on top of the posts.
Correct. Or any that I'm aware of.
Yeah. But I mean, if there are, great. That's awesome.
Maybe a rapier style or two. I could see how would be beneficial to learning rapier.
Yeah, it's fun. It's dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, if you don't have good balance.
Well, especially isn't the main armament in Bagua like a very long sword?
That's one of the armaments.
Okay.
The main idea of Bagua is to move like the wind. I know it sounds so poetic. Wow. But
everything, I mean, I say this with endearment, everything in Asian martial arts sounds like a poem.
All right. Well, that's because they used to teach with poetry so that you could recite the poetry and not have to know how to read.
I mean, not that that was probably a long time ago, but not that long ago in Brazil, they taught with street dance because that's right. The only way they were allowed to do it. So
right.
So that was not very long ago at all.
Yeah. But yeah, the idea of Bagua is to when something comes right at you is to spin out of the way. Mm-hmm. Basically not be there when an attack comes towards you, you're no longer there.
Just to interject really quickly, I know Courtney from Saberlight uses Bagua as a foundation for his Serasu in a big way. And though I have no personal experience actually practicing Bagua, I have visually studied a lot of it and take to a lot of elements when I do Serasu as well. And when I'm coming up with Serasu concepts and exercises and things, I try to visualize or make it sort of visually appear that similar way, the circular motion, spinning or I hate to say just spinning, but like, you know, the dodging aspect, the getting out of the way, like you're saying. But again, I don't have personal experience, so it's kind of like, ooh, that looks like Ceresu. We talked about this an episode or two ago. That looks like Ceresu. Well, that looks like Bagua. Well, to me, they look like each other.
Yes.
In a big way.
That's what I was gonna. Yeah. I was gonna get to was the fact that the principle is to not be there, right? And we talked about Ceresu last time about how we want to. I think you called it a null.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nullify an attack.
Well, and we tell the kids at my current gym, what is the best? This is one of our drills we do every day. What's the best self-defense technique to not be there is the answer.
Yeah.
So anyway, continue.
Oh, no, I was agreeing with you.
Yeah. I mean.
Yeah. Best way to not get hit by a train is to not stand on the tracks.
Exactly. Well, and Bagua is teaching you how to not stand on the tracks best.
Yeah.
Right? Would that be correct? Well,
yeah, the thing about Bagua, which is kind of fun, is that it is the stepping is meant for you to address multiple opponents.
Now, right.
The reason it's eight is because of the cardinal directions and the non-cardinal directions.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, so if you get attacked by multiple people, generally speaking, only about eight people will be able to surround you with any kind of efficacy, you know. If they're barehanded, maybe four if they have weapons.
That is so funny. I was just watching something today about Yaido, the art of drawing the sword, and multiple attackers, and they have kata for 1, 3, 4, 5, and 7 I think attackers. And so it's funny that you say eight is like the maximum, and even then, there you go. There's a tradition right there. They don't even go up to eight.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it is.
It's all theoretical, first of all.
Well, yeah. Mainly the idea was to get the maximum amount of people around you that can attack efficiently,
right? And not hurt each other, right?
And not, yes, that's what I mean by efficiently, is to actually do it without hurting each other.
Yep.
And for most melees, they're like on a big battlefield, you know, you're usually dealing with the people in front of you.
Right.
Right. And sometimes there are 10 people in front of you, but really only one of them has to get it right.
There you go. Yep.
So that's really the idea is that if you were surrounded somehow, right, by a bunch of people, only about eight people can actually attack you at the same time because they're coming from these different directions. Mm-hmm. And yes, if correctly done, they can all attack and you can be surrounded by a bunch of people shoulder to shoulder. I will give that conceit to you, but they won't do it efficiently.
Yeah.
So the idea of attacking multiple opponents not attacking multiple opponents.
Being attacked by.
Addressing multiple opponents, I guess is the better way to do it, is one of the tenets of Bagua. So there's a lot of stuff if you are hearing this and you look it up, there's a lot of turning and spinning and all that fun stuff. So a lot of the things that made equilibrium cool, like, you know, the gun kata, where statistically we put ourselves in a position where we're not going to get hit, you know, by the next technique or the next move. That's kind of the idea in Bagua. I want to move and address this attack so I don't get hit by the next one.
Is the idea of Ceresu, right? I mean,
right.
Don't be here for this attack so that you can either counterattack or address the next attack, right? I mean,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where I was gonna go with it, is there is a parallel with the resilience form here. Mainly because as you do Bagua, you actually don't breathe consciously. There's no like full-on kiai in Bagua.
Right.
There's a because you will breathe mainly as you go through the motions, the twisting and turning of your body breathes for you.
Yeah.
Which is a cool thing that is done. Just there's like this internal, because it's considered an internal martial art, right? So there's an internal thing that happens when you walk counterclockwise, and then when you walk clockwise in your body, if you've ever, you know, as a kid spun around in a room, you know, over and over again, getting dizzy. So a lot of Bagua is actually stirring up the blood and the chi in that direction as you walk and as you turn and as you compress and stretch your spine and as you compress and stretch your limbs and twist and turn, it breathes for you. Let's, so a lot of the things are very much Suresu-like.
I don't want to spend any time on this at all, but I feel like we should, just because you said a word, and you know exactly mm-hmm. what word you said, that is gonna make some people smirk, is gonna make some people frown, it's gonna make some people laugh, and it's gonna make et cetera, et cetera. And that word is chi. Okay, so let's just really quickly, let's ignore the fine work that McDojo Life has done.
Sure.
And let's just define chi really quickly in the simplest term that makes sense, that does not involve no touch knockouts. Simply, it's the energy that already exists in everybody's body anyway.
Sure, I'll do you one better.
Sure, yeah, please.
Well, let's explain three things.
Sure.
Let's explain the word jing, the word chi, and the word shen.
Go.
These are called the three treasures in Chinese medicine. Jing, chi, and shen. Jing is what you can touch, you can feel. It's the chunk that is there, right? So we can say a plant has jing because we can touch the plant. We can say a rock has jing because we can touch the rock.
Okay.
You know, we can touch, you know, a human being. That's jing.
Well, you might say in English, like a physical presence.
Right, something that you can touch.
Sure.
Is the easiest way to express the idea of jing.
Okay.
Okay, but what about wind? What about fire? Those things you can touch, yeah?
Yeah.
But they don't stay still.
Right.
Right. Water has jing, but is it actually something I can hold on to?
Okay.
Yeah, but it'll flow out of your hand.
Okay.
Right? So that's jing. Everything that we can see, touch, and feel is jing.
Okay.
Now, there's another idea called qi, which is motion, which is energy, which is the thing that I just described as wind, and what we describe as fire, what we describe as water, things that we can touch but can't touch for long.
Okay.
That's an idea, right? And then there's this thing called shen. Shen roughly translates into spirit, but actually means consciousness, right? So the idea of jing, qi, and shen completes a being, right? So if you have jing, you have form. If you have qi, you have energy that you can move around. You can do it of your own consciousness, shen. Mm-hmm. So really the idea of jing, qi, and shen, and again, this is Chinese medicine stuff that, you know, I learned years ago, is basically your intention becoming manifest. So qi is just another way to express emotion. Qi is your breath. Qi is your inner fire. Qi is all these things that people have tended to abuse the meaning of, right?
That's what I was getting at when I said that doesn't involve no touch. Basically,
yeah,
we're not trying to sell people snake oil with what Alan's telling you. He's yeah. coming at this from the pragmatic sense of the word.
Yeah. And, right. and what we're meaning is, and if you don't believe that she exists, I would like you to please clench your fist as hard as you can for about a minute. And then when you let it go, tell me you don't feel anything. Tell me you don't feel your fist still clenched.
Yeah, and just that, like, if
that feeling is chi.
If we're going to be a little bit even, like, sort of insensitive, like, just because you don't call it chi doesn't mean that it doesn't mean the same thing. It means the same right. thing. Whatever you call it is what you call it, but you can't deny that you feel...
It's a living field that permeates all living yeah. things.
I mean, look, if you believe in somewhat in the force, right? Yeah. But... You can measure the actual amount of energy in a person in many different ways.
Yeah.
So
taught us that.
How can you deny that chi, whatever you define it as long as you the way you right. defined it is very good, but just for mm-hmm. for anybody that sort of like wants to hit the off button because they heard that word, like that's not we're not talking about the same chi that yeah. George Dillman is talking about. Can I just put it that bluntly? Okay, it's not this. We're talking about the same chi, but not the same way.
Yeah, and also it's, you know, it is much like I hate to say it, but much like religion, you get out of it what you want.
Exactly. Exactly. So anyway, Alan. Yeah. Bagua. The idea of chi, you explained it perfectly. I just wanted to kind of jump. I didn't want to, but I felt like I kind of had to jump on the train for just a second. Sure. But let's get back on the Ceresi train real quick and the Bagua train. Because sure. I'm very fascinated by the aspect of the longsword. Is it the Dadao? Is that what it's called?
There's a couple of ones of it. But yeah, the Bagua broadsword, is that what you're talking about? The five foot long...
Almost looks like a katana.
No, we're talking about that's a dragon fast sword. That's a different one.
Okay.
But you can't. There is actually a Bagua form for it. But
okay.
The more popular weapon for Bagua is the actual broadsword. So it looks like a
like a normal broadsword.
Imagine a normal broadsword, but it's as big as you.
I don't think I've seen. I feel like a lot of the stuff I've seen was either with a normal size broadsword or that long katana style Chinese sword. Sure. But
well, those exist.
Maybe I'm looking at the wrong videos too.
Well, if you look, it's hard to get those swords anymore, like commercially.
Yeah.
But they used to sell them before.
Yeah, you don't see anything like that in the martial arts, like magazines and stuff, like the standard distributors. You can't find anything like that.
Yeah, you would need to know a guy that knew a guy that knew shipping container in, you know, it's a thing.
In a seedy village in Singapore, yeah.
Yeah, and now it's a little bit tougher to get because nobody really teaches it because not a lot of people know it, but... It's one of those things that once you see it, you're like, holy crap.
Well, I bring up the longsword because I'm very intrigued by this aspect of in Japanese sword, they have a term for it, but the term means to keep the katana close to your body at all times, mm-hmm. Particularly in defensive times when you turn your back to or through where an attack is going to come from. Mm-hmm. And in Star Wars, we see the block behind the back all the time. But
sure.
Like keeping that saber or that sword or weapon or even just your hands, if it happens to be empty-handed, to where you don't have to reach for defense and you also like you can reach if you had to. You can reach the things you need to, but you don't ever have to leave home base. With your defensive posture. In other words, like if I'm turning one way, I'm covering my exit with the sword and then I turn the sword into the new direction as I enter that direction. So the harmony of the blade and body is really a big deal in my observations. Excuse me. Am I off base with that, or am I kind of seeing the right thing?
Well, a lot of it is you're saying all the right things. You're saying the right things. The idea of this particular broadsword, right? If you look up Bagua broadsword,
I'm doing it right now, actually, as we speak. I'm gonna grab my computer and look it up.
Yeah, Bagua. Bagua. Okay. You'll see that the idea is that you can't swing the sword. You cannot swing this sword. It is far too big for you to muscle your way through. So the idea is you have to use your body. You have to have, I think the word you used was harmony.
Mm-hmm.
You actually have
holy crap, this thing is huge.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh.
So the the
yeah, no,
the idea
is a big ass sword.
The idea is to actually be so in tune with your weapon that as you move, your weapon moves itself.
And so, this picture I'm looking at, this little wushu man, the blade is pretty much as tall as he is when he's in his cat stance.
Correct. Yeah, it's a 5 foot tall broadsword.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
There's this little old man holding one. This may be a photoshopped image, but this looks like a 6 or 7 foot blade. Did they make those as well?
Yeah, they make it to size.
Yeah. And what about the rings on the back? Okay. Is that on? I see one here. It says Bagua Dao Wushu. You know, it's some sort of knockoff, but it has rings all down the back. Now, I've seen the rings on demonstration Dao before. Mm-hmm. But did the rings actually serve a purpose in battle, or was that a ceremonious sort of a thing?
So there's two things that the rings do.
Okay.
And you're probably looking at the 9-ring sword right now.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There you go. 9.
So the idea of that sword is that it would cut and it would open a wound, and the rings would catch anything inside that wound.
Oh, that's gruesome.
Yeah. So it's pretty rough, right?
Oh, coming from experience with bows and arrows going through deer, let's just, you know, if you're a vegetarian, first of all, sorry for your life. Second of all, go get a cheeseburger. Third of all, I apologize for all those rude things I just said. Keep listening to the show. Thank you for your subscribership. But just coming from that experience as a hunter, where I've seen projectiles, bullets, and arrows going through animals, and sort of the trauma post-haste, I could tell you that the sharper the better for not just you as the hunter, but also for that animal as the experiential vessel through which that projectile passes. So getting a sharp blade is bad enough, but then to have all these blunt, open, mangly things rattling the frick around inside of you, that's trauma that can't be patched up.
Correct.
That's pretty much a lightsaber now. That's like instant kill shot every time.
Yeah, so the idea...
Not to mention the weight behind it when you chop something.
Yeah. That's the idea of the 9-ring broadsword.
Holy crap. Ew. Gross.
Yeah.
Plus that sound. Like, if you were on the battlefield and you'd seen one of your buddies skewered by one of those, and then you hear, like, somebody walking around with one of those, there's a psychological effect there.
Yes. Well, it's meant to also teach you you're doing it right. There is a specific sound that my teacher can leave the room and know that I'm doing my broadsword correctly.
Like a certain ting or ping or ring that the rings have versus when you're doing it wrong. There's a sort of rung, if you will.
Yes, correct. Yes, so there is a... Those are the two reasons.
For very interesting.
9 rings.
Very, very interesting. Well, actually... That seemed to me for many years to be sort of one of those gimmicky things that, you know, every martial arts has gimmicky things. Don't sure. Brazilian jiu-jitsu people stop talking right now because you know you do too. in all seriousness, every martial art, Kenpo too, has their gimmicky things. And I thought that was one, but that actually, that makes so much sense all across the board. Mm-hmm. Every part of that makes sense.
Yeah, it's pretty rough.
There's, again, to use the Japanese comparison, there is a sound that a katana is supposed to make when you swing it. And if it doesn't make that sound, it's not called that thing. And if you don't have that thing, you're not doing it right.
Correct.
And I can't say the word. I can't pronounce it right. But you know what I'm talking about. And that's really all swords, any weapon. Like if you swing an axe around and you swing it in sort of like a battle posture, if you will, it should make certain sounds versus other sounds when it cuts through the air. A stick, even. It's a round object. It can't really make different sounds, but there's a sharper sound that it makes when you swing a cleaner path, if that makes sense.
I was going to say, a lot of scrimmadores are screaming into their phone right now or whatever the listening device is. There has to be a correct sound.
Yes, absolutely. It should sing. It should have a singing nature to it. And let's go back to the length of it for a second too. And even with lightsabers, like when you're swinging a lightsaber around, it's very close to a stick, right? So it should have a certain sing to it. And let's go to the long blades real quick, because it is becoming somewhat popular in tournaments to offer a great saber or great sword style saber option. And this is not a bad way to learn how to use a sword if that's a weapon choice you're going to make. Let's go really deep into the nerd boy realm real quick. People are going to love, because we are still at our core a Star Wars fan organization and podcast, right?
Yeah.
And Corrin Horn from the old Legends Expanded Universe, if you will.
Wow.
Yeah. He had what you call...
It's been many years since I've heard that name.
Yes. He had what you call a dual-phase lightsaber. And it would... He may have even had more than this, but in all the stuff I can remember, it was two lengths. He could turn it on one color, and I believe it was yellow, and I could be wrong about that. It might have been green, but it was a standard-length sword. And he would like twist his hilt in a way, and then it would basically become like a 6 or 7 foot blade, and it would change color to like silver, I believe. But the way he used it and the way it was written that he used it differed. As soon as he twisted that hilt, like his fighting style would change.
Yes.
So
very, very much like our previous episode.
Yes. Yeah, when we talked about Cal Kestis, correct. And it's kind of weird, because Kay and I were talking a few days ago on the episode that will have just been released, episode 29, about, you know, when you first learn, you learn a punch, then you learn another punch, then you learn a kick, then you learn another kick, then you learn this, then you learn that, and you learn all these things. Then over time, a punch is just a punch, then a kick is just a kick, blah, 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 blah. Then you get your black belt, and it becomes important again to know all these, because you got to teach it. But then over time again, you experience other martial arts. You experience interactions with other martial arts. And a punch is just a punch. Again, right? So this circle just completes itself over and over again. And to me, with the swords, it's kind of like that, where you might learn a short sword or a broad sword or a straight sword or a double-edged sword or a single-edged sword or, you know, a short sword or knife or whatever. But yes, they have their nuances and their different fighting styles that you can sort of fall into. But at the end of the day, a sword is still just a sword. A knife is, right? You can only cut and stab with it. That's all you can do with it, and block.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about like that nuance when you start to change blades. And like, even though I'm talking all this good game about punch is a punch, sword is a sword, it still does have nuance. There's still, you still have to practice. Like if you're going to, add 3 inches to your polycarbonate blade, you better practice with that blade, because that 3 inches might throw you off, especially if you haven't changed your hilt.
Right. And the strength of your wrist, right?
Well, and like I told you a few minutes ago, all the Bagua stuff I'd seen had been just a couple different weapons. I hadn't really seen sort of the things you're talking about. So, yeah. But you know, it goes both ways. You can train sort of for all of the universal weaponry, or you can train in a universal way so that any weaponry you take, and I don't think they have to be mutually exclusive. You can sort of use both of those camps, right?
Right.
Because you have to taste every weapon, right? Like, you have to try them.
Right.
But at the same time, your training style has to be able for you to be able to pick anything up and still use it.
Right. Well, a lot of this comes down to what works and what doesn't work, right? And what is the intention of said weapon?
There's that word again. It's an important word.
Yeah. So if we're talking about a Bagua broadsword, probably the worst weapon, right? It's you show up with that, it's an intimidation display, but as soon as you have to swing it, you've probably messed up in many more ways than one.
I would even argue, and I think we talked about this on that video game episode too, like, the fewer enemies that you're facing, the worse that weapon becomes for you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where the training is not to go one-on-one with that weapon. The training is fighting multiple opponents in order to find a way out.
But the training system can be universally used to learn other weaponry.
Exactly. So the concept, right? Well, let's talk about the concept of different weapons.
Yeah.
The Bagua broadsword is meant for you to learn how to move your body to get out of the way of your blade.
Hmm. Yeah.
And then you use that on smaller weapons. It's a means to an end. It's like what a tetsubo is for Japanese martial arts. You use a tetsubo much like a Major League Baseball player uses the weighted bat, right? Mm-hmm. He puts the weights on the bat to swing, to help his swing, to kind of get the right thing. That's what a tetsubo is. Because if you take the tetsubo techniques and put a sword in its place, the sword should be able to cut the air at a much quicker pace.
Sure.
Than a tetsubo would. And that's the kind of thing that's going on with this, is you're not swinging the broadsword to take out one guy. You're using this broadsword to take on multiple opponents. You're taking on, you know, 8 different directions and a lot of level changes as you use it. Because if you don't keep moving, the sword will hit you and break your wrist. And it'll be a very bad time indeed for the person using the broadsword. And it's like, you know, there's a bunch of different weapons that teach other weapons, the staff being one of them, right?
Yes.
If you can use a staff, then you can probably use a spear, you know. In Filipino martial arts, you know, you train with the sticks so you can learn how to use the knife, you use the knife so you can learn how to use your hands.
Yeah.
It's like one of those things, just like there is a way of teaching that every weapon will give you. Now, you can practice these things in their normal form, right, in the way that you are taught, or you can take it, and as I believe martial arts should be done, and share them with other things. So if you are practicing with a Bagua broadsword, that some of those techniques can be turned into other techniques and with other martial arts, with other ideas.
Like Suresu, maybe?
Like Suresu, like Gemso, yep. Like a bunch of things. You know, think, because, spoilers, my Gemso is heavily influenced by Bagua broadsword.
Interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, so, but now I can see to some degree why.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's because the ideas of Bagua broadsword, to me, make a lot more sense in Jemso than it does in Soresu. Though Bagua itself would be more Soresu.
Sure, sure. I get the distinction you're making there.
Yeah. But then again, it's also the interpretation of said thing, right? So my interpretation would be different than yours, which is awesome. Because go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you kind of made me think of something that I've always kind of wanted to do on this show, but I feel like sometimes when I've wanted to do it, maybe we've had too many people on to where it would have just made the episode ridiculously stupid long and nobody would listen. But I kind of want to tickle the idea of like some of the weaponry that has influenced our saber forms, because that's kind of where we're taking the conversation organically. Mm-hmm. Or martial arts, maybe that because sometimes it's not just a weapon. Sometimes, like you said just now, that distinction you made between Bagua influencing Soresu versus the Bagua sword influencing Jemso. So like, okay, let's just
version of it.
Right, sure. But that's going to be different for me, obviously.
Right.
Doesn't mean it's better or worse. I'm curious now. So like, let's just talk about Chi Cho really quickly. I mean, obviously, I think everybody has the katana, principles of kendo, possibly, I know for myself, long sword and hand and a half type sword has a big influence on my Chi Cho. What other kinds of things influence your Chi Cho as well?
So my Chi Cho is based on several things. First off, the Kihon, or the five fundamentals of kendo. That I was told, and I'm probably butchering the name of.
Yeah,
I am Filipino, guys. I'm not Japanese. I apologize.
I mean, if people are going to get offended by that these days, I mean, I'm Italian, and the number of Italian words that people say every single day that just get butchered and trounced all over. I mean, I can't get offended, or I'd be ticked Thanks, off Olive at Garden. Everybody. Yeah, really.
When I was taught, so I do a style called Toyama-ju, which is was explained to me. Again, I was not there when it was created, so I don't at me. It was created when the Japanese decided to consolidate their sword training after World War II, basically. A bunch of the schools got together and said, okay, forget all the BS. What are the principles of swordplay? And so that's the type of...
Sure.
Of
That's the main idea of teaching Chi Cho, really, to me, is cut out the BS, because you're assuming, first of all, this person's never even touched a sword, right?
Right.
And even if they have, you want them to come at it from a clean slate anyway. So, to me, that makes a lot of sense.
So that's where it's heavily influenced.
Now, what about some little secondary influences that people might not have thought of?
Sure. Well, I also have dabbled in other sword forms and things, and dang it, you can only swing a sword a couple of ways.
Yeah, that's it.
Right?
So, around or straight. That's it.
So I have in my Chi Cho taught the basic cuts that come from knife fighting, and also the basic. So basically, we swing our sword at Phoenix Saber Academy. We swing our sword like a katana. We swing our sword like a knife. We swing our sword like a stick. So sure, a lot of the eskrima, a lot of the things, all the numbering systems, all that stuff, basically we took, assimilated, and then... We did what the Jikendo practitioners always say. We absorbed what was needed, and we forgot the rest.
Yeah, that's what it should be, and that's kind of I mean, we'll go through the other forms as well, but for me, shicho, it's a lot of, it can be influenced by a lot of things. Like when I'm teaching, or I don't even want to say teaching, working with Andy or Bede, he's never trained martial arts except with me with lightsabers. And his eye, though, he's so athletic, and his eye for these things, for technique, is really sharp. So, like, he has just these influences from his daily life that make it into his sword work that, like, he's actually a pretty decent fighter. Mm-hmm. But, like, if I didn't know martial arts, I wouldn't be able to pick up on these non-martial arts things he's doing in a martial way.
Right.
I teach this one thing in shicho, and it, you know, it's a one-handed technique that I don't teach a whole ton of strictly one-handed techniques, although anything can be done one or two-handed. But it's this move where you step back and line the person up almost like a Suresu salute, and you've cocked your saber back all the way to your far chest, and then you do a step-through stab that just goes all the way through the target. And it's a big motion. You load it up, and a lot of times you can see it coming, right? But it when it hits, it hits, and it hits every time. And Andy came up with this. He's like a pretty good pool player, or at least at one point he was. This is straight out of the billiards club. Like he's lining up with the fingers, the pool cue, and taking a shot. But he didn't know that's what he was doing. And I told him one night, I was like, dude, that is right out of the pool hall. Like, where did that thing? And it hurt. Like, he hit me with a foam saber and that freaking hurt. And I was like, dude, that is an awesome move. And I'm going to start teaching that in shicho, because it teaches you the beauty of coming from a place of no knowledge almost, but also all the knowledge, if that makes sense. Right. And he used to also be a pretty good skateboarder. So, like, his linear footwork is really good and his balance is really good. So, like, these are the types of things where I go, okay, balance drills. Like, it's not even from martial arts. It's from freaking skateboarding. Yeah. I'm a terrible skateboarder, by the way. But just watching him do his footwork so efficiently without having martial arts training, I'm like, what did he do that? How did he get that? Oh, that's right. He skateboarded. Like, it makes all the sense. I can see the influence right there in front of me. So anyway, you kind of see where I'm going with this exercise now, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk a little Makashi now. Let's give some obvious answers, some martial artsy answers, and then maybe some not so obvious answers. Fencing. Okay. Yeah. Sports fencing. Let's get that one out of the way. Sport fencing. Let's get it out of the way. Rapier saber. Definitely those. For you, I know specifically Polish saber, correct?
Yes.
And Chinese straight sword, correct?
Japan, yeah.
Anything I'm maybe not privy to as much, or something a little more subtle?
So the Makashi that I teach has a parallel with a specific Jien form. That's called Man, Heaven, and Earth Straight Sword. But it's basically addressing three things. Basically slashing both directions and then piercing.
Right.
That's kind of what you'll see out of every straight sword form.
Which, like but we said a few minutes ago, is really the only two things you can do with a sword anyway.
Yeah. But the main thing that happens with that straight sword is that it actually is taught with a partner. So the idea that I put into it to kind of help everybody understand is that you have to do this with a partner. This is the contention form. Who are you contending with?
Right.
You know, so when I actually teach Makashi, it's mainly meant for a dueling pair. So it's more like dancing.
Yes. My Makashi forms are all versus one opponent or one theoretical opponent.
Yeah, so that's kind of the idea that I do for Makashi itself.
I personally, yeah, I've seen some of your Makashi stuff, so I visually have a reference for what you're describing. But if people would like to watch, a couple episodes ago, we did a breakdown of Alan's Makashi five strike combo, and that's kind of a good visual starting point for anybody who wants to kind of see what you're talking about. And that is done with a partner. And I really like how you, this is one of the things I like about your teaching, is you use that word that's associated with each form. Each form has its unique definition or
right.
term associated with determination, which, you know, just based on the examples I gave of somebody who's never done martial arts being determined to basically invent techniques on the fly to win an exchange, right? I mean, here you are. You have to do it with a partner because contention is the idea. 1v1, getting the better of one other person, getting the better of somebody who could be better than you. Or your equal, you know, rising above your equal. Giving,
just like the song says.
Yeah. Well, or, you know, here's another one, and this is something you see a lot in professional fighting, is kind of leaving the ladder down for somebody lower than you to climb, and face you and potentially best you when you know you are or should be better. So, you know, I really like that aspect of it. For me personally, Makashi has a lot of Eskrima, not really, but just the aspect of covering, because I do teach with the hand behind the back, but I also teach to some degree with the hand in front, with the offhand in front for Makashi. Sure. Some of those concepts come from Eskrima for me, but actually a lot more rapier and saber. But also,
the funny thing about that is,
go ahead,
that a lot of the stepping that we do in our Makashi form is actually mimicked, or not mimicked, but
modeled after.
Yeah, repeated in traditional Kali and Eskrima as, like, this is a basic step. This
Okay. So there you go.
A lot of that. So you'll see a lot of geometry. If you're any sort of martial artist, you'll see that this is also not just an anatomy class, but also a geometry class. A lot of the stepping and all the circles and the triangles that you see that are on the floor of dojos are actually there to help you kind of remember the steps.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you go different places, you know, a lot of concepts are explained through just doing. They're not really explained in like a book. So, but for some reason, there's all these freaking shapes everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There's circles and triangles and squares all over the walls and all over the dojo or studio or, you know, school, ludus, whatever you call it, whatever you're doing your thing. But it's all meant for you to learn some of the things that transcend language. So different types of movement, different types of geometry. All that stuff is shared by all martial arts, and it is really good to actually learn it, because it'll only help you learn more.
Yeah.
And learn faster.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's where the Makashi comes from. The Meyer Square,
I came into the Meyer Square late in life. And I'm probably wrong about this in Meyer's original intention, but we can't ask the guy. But I found myself largely dissatisfied with a lot of the teaching content I've found on the Meyer Square. And what I mean by that is a lot of the people I've found to teach on it have just kind of regurgitated what they interpreted to read in the manuscripts, which is not that that's how you do it. I get it. That's how you do it. That being said, I don't sense a lot of innovation in their interpretations. And I come at that. Sorry.
I was gonna say like let's call a spade a spade. There are no old masters in saber martial arts.
Yes,
but HEMA is about 10 years older than saber martial arts.
Yeah, so right. Exactly. So that's when I caveat with all these like I might be wrong and this might that's how any martial art is generated anyway.
Right.
But
and it's up to us to keep on working on it, guys.
Well, I find there's a lack of innovation when I hear these interpretations in the sense that like okay, I've heard somebody say that Meyer only wanted you to strike diagonally. You could never ever strike horizontally or vertically. It's clearly BS. Just because he only numbered the diagonal, he puts a cross right then and there. Now I understand that cross might be where you're not supposed. But why can't we interpret it in all these ways? Why can't we practice it in all these, right? So like this speaking in absolutes thing, and this is, it's not exclusive to the Meyer Square. It's just a lot of the content I found on the Meyer Square, I found it not to be useful to my practice the way I want it to be. And I found the most use out of it from just freaking reading Meyer, right? From just looking at the manuscript myself and going, oh, okay. I mean, the guy wanted you to cut any way you could cut. He just happened to think that these were the main directions for swordplay. Great. For the longsword, it makes a lot of sense too. Like swinging diagonally is hella more comfortable than horizontal. But we have all these horizontal cuts. We have these thumb cut and supinated and pronated. And there. So clearly the guy did not only think you could cut diagonally. Whoever taught that, I don't remember who it was. Don't watch that video, right? But like, anyway, you got me on a bit of a tangent. I'm an emotional tangent. There's some things where I go, man, I really want to learn about this, and then I start learning about it, and I'm like, man, no people, either I don't understand it, or the people teaching it don't understand it, or nobody understands it. But it's not helping me at all.
Right. But again, you take all the stuff that's interpreted out of a book.
Yeah. And
interpreted. I'm saying interpreted because, like you said, Meyer isn't here for you to, you know.
You got to look at the good, the bad, and the ugly. And
let's face it.
Look at it yourself.
Is the reason there are no old masters is because this didn't come along. These manuals didn't come along with a lineage, right?
That's true too. Yeah. I mean, maybe a little bit where this guy learned from this guy once or twice, right? Or this guy sparred with that guy. But not like...
There was no direct line, right?
Yeah. There was no passing of the torch, so to speak, like Ed Parker to Jeff Speakman or, Alan, I'm sure you could fill in the blanks for years with the Chinese side of that, but the Gracies to other Gracies, as it were.
Yeah, so there's no like, whenever you hear guys debate about it, it's kind of fun to listen to, but like to be a part of it, it's like, well,
it's really an exercise in ego stroking to a large degree. To listen, I think you need to filter, right? You need to take things in and filter, and there's definitely good things to be gleaned. And I'm just using Myers Square because that's the topic you brought up real quickly. But anyway, I think that the larger concept at hand is you need to be critical of things, but also I think it's important to look like – having seen so many what I thought were bad interpretations forced me to go look at the manual myself and go, okay, well, this was actually pretty good and this person was not too far off, or, you know, and again, that's all just my opinion, really, because I'd love to, but I, like we said, I can't buy the guy a beer and ask him. I just can't. Okay, Suresu. I'll start this one. Really easy, right off the bat. Any of my training with Chinese broadsword, any of my training with defensive stick techniques, and even a lot of my knife training, and anything where parrying and blocking was a big part of it, and those three in particular happened to be the most, in my mind, the most vivid translations of defense. That's what influenced my Suresu in a big way. And I come from a very defensive martial art, but also a counter-offensive martial art, so we'll get to that in a minute. But for Suresu, all the blocking and stuff, and just the sense of the outer rim, the shell of protection, whatever you like to call it, that all comes from my karate training and the stick training that went along with that. Because in a lot of Kenpo schools, they will include elements of Arnis and Eskrima training. Mine was no different. Ed Parker was a big fan of the stick as a weapon because you could find a stick anywhere. And people will swing sticks at you, so you can get a stick from anyone. So sticks and knives, big deal in Kenpo. So I had a lot of training against people who had weapons when I did not have a weapon. And, you know, again, a lot of this stuff is theoretical and may not actually work in real situations. But when you translate it to we both have a weapon, now you sort of see these defensive elements take shape. And you're able to employ them a little better. On a little bit less obvious side of life, I got a lot of my Suresu influence from Andy as well, in the sense that two things. One, he's a huge Obi-Wan fan. So, like, my motivation was I wanted to develop a style that he would approve of, right? Having known the lore of Obi-Wan and such, but also something that he could be like, ooh, I kind of like that. I want to get into that. But the other reason is he has a strong sense of self-preservation. Like, he does not like to get hit. He does not like, and he's not a wimp, but he does not want to get in a fight, right? So, like, just that sense, because I also don't like to get hit, but I'm sort of the opposite in that if you hit me, like, oh, I'm gonna hit you now. Oh, I'm gonna hit you now. Just wait for it, right? Like, I'm sort of vengeful. And he's a lot more passive in that regard. His vengeance is with his tongue, not with his sword. So I learned a lot of that,
ladies.
That sort of patient self-preservation. That's funny. patient self-preservation. So that's kind of my unobvious choice. We talked a little bit about Suresu. Just touch on anything we kind of missed for you.
Sure. So Suresu is, like all of these things, there's self-study involved, right?
Yeah, sure.
But the form, because I teach basically katas for all the forms.
Yep.
For the form I selected for, the Suresu for Phoenix Saber Academy is the form that is actually a dragon fast sword, which is the long straight sword that, you know, you like talking about. But it can be done with katana, right?
Cause, sure.
You know, why not? I'll just tell you the story. So the story behind the form that I teach is that a Chinese monk from the Shaolin Temple went to the Shaolin Temple in Japan, which is called Shoryuan. So it's a different temple. But one of his forms was the sword, but he couldn't, when he went over, you know, take your weapons away, et cetera, et cetera. But he still had the ideas, right? So the only sword that he could find was a katana. So he just went, okay, well, just do the form I know, but I'll do it with this katana. So it's basically a Chinese-Japanese hybrid form.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually a family form. So, like, the people that know it, you know, are part of a lineage. So the idea that of the Suresu, the two-handed Suresu that we do, stems from that. Then
Okay.
the other type of Suresu that we do is the one-handed version, which is based on what's called a Tiger Tornado Broadsword, which is a one-handed form that teaches a single broadsword, so one-handed, you know, Chinese
Yep.
Dao, and then it teaches broadsword and shield, teaches broadsword and chain whip, and double broadsword, all at the same time. So
Interesting.
when my students learn, you know, my style of Suresu, it's actually they're learning a bunch of different weapons at the same time.
It's
They
crafty.
don't,
I like that.
yeah, they don't know it yet,
I
but
mean,
that's kind of the
in
thing.
theory, if you're doing true saber mar true true quote unquote true, I mean, we coined the term, so we can say whatever we want. If you're doing true saber martial arts, if you're doing true saber martial arts, you should be learning a whole bunch of different weapons without even realizing it every time you learn a form. Which takes us into Ataru, and probably for some people the most interesting form, but certainly one of the flashiest. And my biggest influence for Ataru was, I always liked the idea of being a little more acrobatic with my sword. And I use the term acrobatic not to mean flips and tricks, but to mean athletic motion. Changing directions quickly, keeping your opponent guessing with your footwork, maybe jumping, maybe spinning. Flipping, probably not, but the aspect of flipping your sword work, things like that. But when I was going for my second black belt training, going through that, I call it my thesis weapon, but I really got into the tomahawk and the knife in a big way, but particularly the tomahawk. And there's not a whole lot of training you can get in true Native American style martial arts unless you're one of them, which I'm not. And you do have to look, observe, ask questions. Man, you'd be shocked at, maybe not, maybe you wouldn't, but I feel like a lot of people would not just go up to people who showed that they may, let's just say it this way, people who showed that they had experience with the tomahawk. And ask them questions about their culture and how they use it. Because sometimes they're not going to answer you. But sometimes they
Nor
are.
should
And sometimes they're really going to
they.
share a lot. And these days I feel like they do want to share a lot, but man, that's a weapon that teaches itself in a large way too. And I spent 2, 3 years basically exclusively training with that weapon. And what I discovered about it is it's Ataru. It's Ataru through and through. There is no defense with that weapon. Your defense is hacking somebody's arm off as they swing at you. Your defense is getting out of the way as you hack low and hope to catch their knee as they step. Your defense is chopping into the bottom of their chin and sweeping their leg with your leg, then hacking them 4 more times when they hit the ground.
Yes, Sensei.
With that?
Yes, Sensei.
Yeah. I
Yeah,
mean,
the good old
so
Johnny Lawrence.
for me, Ataru is the purest expression of offense. And to me, on earth, tomahawk is the weapon for me that I have found to be my purest form of offense. Now, I know there are some particularly nasty offensive weapons in the African cultures, in many, actually. I know there's some nasty Chinese weapons. Like, I'm just thinking about the chain whip right off the top of my head. Like, that's an Ataru weapon. The Kusarigama, if we're talking Kabuto, which is a kama attached to a chain. I mean, that's not real defensive either. You're swinging that thing and hoping to hook stuff and mangle stuff and take people's defense away. So those are the types of things that influence Ataru for me, in addition to just being in shape. Like, if I've got somebody doing Ataru, they're doing push-ups in weapons class. They're doing sit-ups in weapons class. They're doing squats and jumps. Mm-hmm. They're doing jumping jacks. They're doing laps. Mm-hmm. Because you're going to be working your ass off in a fight.
Yep.
If Ataru is your choice. Yep. Whereas Suresu, you can kind of hang and reserve energy. That form is meant to reserve energy. Ataru is, I've got this energy. I'm just going to it out. And mm-hmm. ideally, you get to the point, maybe you can pick up off of this, Alan. You get to the point where it's a renewable energy in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now let's talk about your Ataru based on sort of that.
Sure. My Ataru is based on a couple of different things. So first off, the sword work is from a style called Nandao, which is another type of broadsword
yep.
that we do, but it's meant to be used as a big old cleaver.
I was going
to
say, looks like a cleaver.
Mm-hmm. And that is meant for you to get your body behind your strike. Right, because again, much like the Boggle broadsword, if your body's not in the right position, you hurt yourself.
Yes, or your sword will hurt you as well.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of my training has also been in Wushu and in like some of the more flamboyant Changshuan, you know, northern styles with all the jumps and the flips and all that stuff. So we actually include that as well as Ditong, which is all the rolls and all the things of that nature.
Yeah.
So when people ask me to teach them Ataru, I'm like, okay, how are your knees?
Yeah. No, it's a serious consideration.
Yeah, and are you willing to do 6 months of Suresu training?
I'm glad you said this. Elaborate.
If I teach you how to do a butterfly kick the first day, you know what'll inevitably happen? The next time you come up to me, you're going to be like, oh, I messed up my leg. I messed up something on landing because I tried to do it too many times. I'm like, well, that's because you're an idiot. The whole idea of Ataru is fighting on uneven ground, and whether that be uneven in the fact that guy's a better fighter than you, or, you know, the actual literal ground is even uneven, right? So when I teach somebody how to do the things that we do in Ataru, it's meant for them to interpret, you know, what that is for them. So if I teach somebody how to do a flip and roll and all that stuff, it's like, okay, but what is your intention? What is your intention with this technique? I think I did it once in one of the Saber Light Knight tournaments. I was fighting Jarkai, which is two sabers, and I did basically a combat roll off to the side, and it was just so out there and unexpected that the opponent got hit by it, but a half second before he hit me, I hit him, and you can hear me say, did I get him? because a lot of the techniques are suicide techniques, basically.
Yes.
You're willing to basically hurt yourself in order to get the point or get the kill in some cases.
Now, and, I like this. Let me mm-hmm. really quickly jump in because mm-hmm. I agree, and I've actually used that exact terminology with my students before, like, okay, if you're ready to learn this, make sure you know that you're going in there suicidally. There are ways, maybe you were going to say that, but there are ways to teach Ataru where it's a blade heavy version and blade first heavy, and you're not necessarily putting yourself, and if you have Ceresu training, like you said earlier, this really helps with this. But to where the blade does all the work for you, and for me, this is a direct lead into Form 7. But we're not going to jump that far ahead. But this is directly how you get into Form 7 for me. Is you master the blade version of Ataru. You need to have the original Ataru, which is blade and body, but there's a blade, what I call a blade-centric version of Ataru, and for me, largely influenced by the two-handed straight sword from Chinese martial arts, the two-handed Jian. And just, I've seen a lot of where these upward figure eights and the blade is constantly in front of the person's body, covering the bases, but still in front of the person's body, and the body's not having to work too hard. And I also picked up a lot of this from Eric, who is in a wheelchair and can fight with all seven forms, and largely his understanding of, or I shouldn't say understanding, but his personal expression of Ataru is a blade only version. There's no footwork. Anyway, in that regard, it would not be as suicidal, but the concept is still the same. You're not defending yourself. The only way to defend yourself with Ataru is to kill them first.
Right. Well, it's aggression, right? So,
right.
When we talk about aggression, it's about being able to attack from unexpected angles
and constantly, constant attack, constant guesswork,
which is the whole point of jumping and doing a roll and doing, you know, a side flip or something of that nature is,
or even just a wide triangle step is kind of like, that's a very simple, but it's still considered acrobatics.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying, is that you don't necessarily have to leave the ground.
Yeah, exactly.
To do the same motion and same, I guess, angle. So I teach a very athletic version, and then I teach the other version, which you just, you know, talked about, which is basically, okay, this is what you are trying to do, and here's how you get your body to do it without having to jump, you know, without having to move in that particular manner. The first time, you can actually pull this off without hurting yourself or busting your knee or whatever.
I have a bad foot. I have bad shins, bad back, bad neck, bad shoulder. Sure. And I can use Ataru still. Once in a while, it does mess with certain aspects of my body in ways where I'm like, man, I should have just stuck to Ceresu today. But I think I have a few Holocron videos I've been recording for Ataru. And I think some of the exercise, when we go over that in a future episode, some of those exercises and things, I think people will get what you mean by that a lot easier, because I'm no gymnast. I mean, I'm relatively martially athletic, but like I'm not a dolphin doing flips and stuff, right? Like I'm no chimpanzee. So, there's ways you can get around this, and a lot of my Ataru is just based on me not being a gymnast. You know, like I'm not Yoda. And that's okay. You don't have to be. You don't really have to be. That's just a fun movie, right? But if you want to have fun with the movie, you have to do it in a way that an Earthling can do it. So, now if you are already an acrobatic person, like we used to tell Keith all the time, like, dude, just get into Ataru, man. You're already teaching parkour. Like, just get into it, man. Why don't you have people flipping into each other and stuff? We say it with tongue in a cheek. But, you know, if that's the kind of stuff you're into, you should be doing choreography and stuff with all that in there. I mean, we want to see it. For sure we want to see it.
You got it.
Okay, I think we should table this. And I think next week we should pick up with 5 through 7 because
okay.
forms 1 through 4 are what I would call maybe 1 through 5, but definitely 1 through 4 are what I would call the basic forms.
Sure.
Everybody learns form 1. Everybody should learn at least some form 2. And then a lot of times people will sort of fall into 3 or 4. But like you said, I recommend everybody learns. They're the basic 4 because you should learn a little bit about each 4.
Yep.
5 through 7, not as critical that you dabble in any of them. But I'm curious to just do the same exercise with you and kind of see, because there's some interesting little tidbits come out of this conversation. So we're almost at an hour and a half. So let's wrap up with a little Strategicon. Alan, go ahead and give us a little update on Strategicon and how anybody can get involved.
Sure. If you are at all interested in saber martial arts or any sort of saber related swinging, we will be at Strategicon Memorial Day weekend. It is the we're gonna be there most of the days, and there will be demo rings. There is at least one big panel that we will be doing, the Saber Martial Arts Summit, in which I am going to try to get people from around the world to even Zoom call in so they can be part of it. Still working on all those details, but if you want to be there, it's at the LAX Hilton on Memorial Day weekend. You're going to go to strategicon.com. I believe the convention is actually called GameX because they do three different cons during the year at the same place. We will be there. Come by, say hi, tell us you love us, tell us you hate us, tell us to challenge us to a duel, whatever. Just show up and share with us your
talk Star Wars, talk old karate kung fu flicks.
Yeah.
Talk about your favorite cheeseburger. Alan likes all those things.
I do love me a cheeseburger. But yeah, all these things and more can be found at sabermartialarts.life and
strategicon.com.
I believe so.
I'll have it linked in the episode. I've had it linked in the last few episodes. Alan, thank you for joining me for our Tricenarian episode here. This has been...
Look at you with the big words.
Yeah, man. We try to pull them out once in a while. That's what she said. thank you very much for listening. Please share with somebody. Please subscribe. And let me do this real quick. We have listeners from all over the globe right now, which, first of all, let me just say thank you so much. If you are listening from anywhere, U.S. or outside of the U.S., thank you very much. Our strongest listener base is definitely in the U.S. right now. But our second strongest listener base, get this, Alan, you ready? Freaking New Zealand.
Hey.
We've got, like, mad homies in New Zealand.
I'm trying to get you guys here.
For this 30th episode here, I want to give a shout out to you New Zealanders. Whoever the hell you are listening to our tiny little podcast here, man, thank you very much, because you have really made our analytics soar. And I'm actually shocked when I look at it and I go, damn, of all the places, right? But it's not really that strange to me because...
No, there are so many hobbits that like lightsabers.
Oh my gosh. Not only that, I mean, how many Kiwis and Aussies have been in Star Wars movies? Like, of the course. Entire Wookiee race was full of the Australian basketball team, right? Or New Zealand basketball team. And not only that, but some of the strongest martial cultures in the world came from New Zealand and Australia.
Those of you in New Zealand, if you can, please contact me.
I was just going to thank you.
I have an idea to do a, and anybody out there can steal this because it's something that I keep on asking and nobody asked about, so just steal it. I would like to celebrate the Maori culture I would like to see if any Maori out there, all the Tongan ninjas out there, I would like to do a Dathomirian haka, if that's possible.
Ooh.
Because that would be such a cool way to open any ceremony. And I would love it if any of you guys could get a hold of us.
Okay, let's do this.
So get a hold of Mark.
Anybody who I just mentioned from New Zealand, Australia, where we have our second strongest listenership in the whole world, you guys are great. If you would like to indulge Alan's request, or even just go ham on us and tell us we're awful, send us...
Or tell us no. Just let us know you exist and what my idea was bad.
Yeah,
it's okay, I can handle it.
Tell us your name. Seriously, first of all, thank you, but sabermaoutreach@gmail.com. That's Saber Martial Arts, but sabermaoutreach@gmail.com. That's me. And Alan can be reached at... Alan, what's the one you prefer for these people listening?
MasterVenable@phoenixsaber.com.
And I will make sure that I put those in the show description as well. So New Zealand, shout out to you guys. Next episode, I'll take a look at our third highest listenership, and you guys will get a shout out. But to celebrating the Islanders this week, celebrating the first four forms, celebrating Bagua, celebrating Alan Venable, celebrating Fode finally shutting up for the night. This has been an amazing episode 30. Thank you for sticking with us. Hopefully for 300 more, and bring your own saber.
This party's over.